It seems like a simple thing, really. Instead of putting on a dress over your head, you put it on like a shirt and tie it closed. You wrap it around you, hence the term wrap dress. Simple concept, but it produced a revolution in fashion when Diane von Furstenberg made the wrap dress big more than 40 years ago. DVF, the accepted shorthand for the designer, is the subject of a new biography by Gioia Diliberto called Diane von Furstenberg, A Life Unwrapped. Gioia Diliberto is a journalist, novelist, and biographer. Her previous biographies have been about Ernest Hemingway's first wife, Jane Addams, and the debutante Brenda Fraser, among others. Gioia, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
I'm struck by the diversity of your subject matter. How do you choose your biography targets?
Well, I always write about women, and I am always looking for a subject who, in her accomplishments or personality or circumstances, seems to step forward and embody the spirit of the time in which she lived and worked. And I think that that requirement I've fulfilled in all of my books. Diane certainly personifies second wave feminism in the 70s, and my book before this one was a novel about Coco Chanel, who personified modernism and fashion during the Jazz Age.
With some of the subjects you portray, like Jane Addams, you don't really get a chance to meet them, but you actually got not only a chance to meet, but got a fair amount of cooperation from Diane von Furstenberg.
Yes, I did. This was the first time that I'd written about someone who was alive, and I don't know that I would do it again, though it worked out well, and Diane and I are on very good terms. I decided that I wanted to write about her. I'd been hunting for another subject, and, you know, a lot of the good dead subjects have already been taken, and there's been a lot of biographies written recently about people who are still alive, and there are a lot of cultural figures who feel that it's better to cooperate with a biographer when they're alive rather than to see their story co-opted after they're gone when they have nothing at all to say about it. So you'll see Warren Buffett cooperated with a biographer, and the writer V.S. Naipaul cooperated with a biographer. And these are biographies that are not authorized, like mine is also not authorized, where the subject had no control over what the writer ended up writing, but decided that they would trust the person because they admired their work and felt that they were honorable, and that it was better to do that than to just wait until they were gone and let whoever say whatever they wanted.
That's a good distinction to make, though, that although she did cooperate with you, welcomed you with open arms, she did not get any editing rights or any prior control over what came out.
No. And that was, you know, towards the end. I think she was really nervous to read the book, and I was really nervous to have her read it. And I tried to, you know, you never know how someone's going to react. And
right.
Oftentimes people don't like the things that you think are fine, and they'll pick on something that you think is completely innocuous as the one thing that they dislike the most about what you've said about them or written about them. So I tried to find all the places in the book that I thought might be upsetting to Diane, and told her about them beforehand. You know, quotes that people had said that I thought she might be offended by, or she might be surprised to find someone had said something negative about her. And I said, you know, I want you to know John Richardson said this about you, just so you won't open the book and be shocked. And she was okay with all of that. She's used to being covered by the press. She's been famous for 40 years, and so she's used to people saying not so nice things about her.
Were you sort of girding, though, for an early morning phone call from Diane von Furstenberg saying, hey, what are you doing here on page 78?
Well, I did. I got an early morning email from her saying that the first time she read it, I think she was just sort of overwhelmed by it. It was a weird, even surreal experience for her, as you can imagine reading a book about yourself would be. And she had some complaints. They were pretty minor. There were a few mistakes, actual mistakes, that she corrected. And so I was glad for that. But she knew the rules, and there was nothing that she found horribly objectionable.
I was just trying to imagine what that must be like, though, sitting in her comfortable home in Connecticut, cracking open a copy of Diane von Furstenberg, A Life Unwrapped, and reading about her life and her pleasant home in Connecticut.
Right.
Be an odd feeling. Help people, Gioia, who are not into fashion, understand why the wrap dress was such a big deal.
Well, I think, first of all, it sold a huge amount and made Diane rich and famous. And at the time, there wasn't much in the way of feminine fashion in the department stores. It was at the end of the hippie era, which was a real anti-fashion era, and the beginning of second wave feminism, when women were going into the workforce in greater numbers than they ever had before in America. And there wasn't much in the way of feminine clothes that women could wear to work, because it was thought at the time that if you wanted to be successful on the job, you had to look like a little man. And so there were a lot of mannish pantsuits and boxy, unattractive suits for women. And there, Diane saw an opportunity to provide a dress that was affordable and was easy to care for. A lot of the early wrap dresses were washable, and that was sexy without being vulgar, and that also could transition from work to a date. And nobody else was doing that, and so she came out with this jersey printed dress that just took off like a tsunami.
It really did send her into the stratosphere, if we can mix metaphors here. We'll come back and talk more about how and the various periods in history that Diane von Furstenberg bridged successfully, it would appear, too. The book is Diane von Furstenberg, A Life Unwrapped. Gioia Diliberto wrote it, and she's our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with her and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the journalist and biographer Gioia Diliberto. She's written a new biography of Diane von Furstenberg called Diane von Furstenberg, A Life Unwrapped. Not an authorized biography, but one that Diane von Furstenberg apparently can live with. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone anywhere in the listening area, by email jx@jeffnet.org. One of the major things that you point out early on in the book, Gioia, is that Diane von Furstenberg is that rare person who was big in fashion, then not, and yet still managed to find her way back into it. That is really rare, isn't it?
She left fashion, did you say?
Well, just that she wasn't as big a deal in fashion for a while and then managed to find her way back into
the inner circle.
Oh,
right, right. She tanked her first business. So she started in the early 70s, and the wrap dress hit in 1974, and she sold it like gangbusters for 2 or 3 years, and then the business tanked in 1977, and she almost lost everything because she was an inexperienced businesswoman. Actually, a lot of fashion designers are inexperienced in business, and she didn't have good advice, and grew too big too fast. And just, women had already had 2 or 3 wrap dresses, and they didn't need any more, and she didn't have anything else to offer. And so she really got out of fashion. She started a cosmetics business, but that didn't do well either. And then she was really out of it for about 10 years and didn't come back until she was 50, which is an ancient age in fashion. And also, fashion is all about what's new and hot and young. And once you leave the front row seat in fashion, you rarely get it back. There's only really one other example of somebody who made a comeback, and that was Coco Chanel, and that was a long time ago. So it was pretty extraordinary what she did.
I'm still curious about the fact that you wrote a novel about Coco Chanel instead of a straight biography. Why?
Well, there had been, I've actually written a play about Coco Chanel also that's having a reading at the Martha's Vineyard Playhouse this coming Monday.
Oh, fun.
There have been lots and lots and lots of biographies of Coco Chanel, and in fact, there have been 2 or 3 more since my novel came out. And I was interested in exploring just this one moment in her life, which was 1919, right after World War One, when she first started her business. And my philosophy of historical fiction is that you should look for a subject or an event that hasn't been explored, not in a nonfiction way, so that you can invent and not without contradicting the truth. And I felt that this moment in Chanel's life in 1919, when she was just starting, was ripe for an historical novel, and it could not be explored in a nonfiction way.
Okay, another book, another day. Right now we're talking about Diane von Furstenberg, A Life Unwrapped. So let's go back to the beginning. Where is Diane von Furstenberg from originally?
She's from Belgium, and she grew up on a street that was not far from where Audrey Hepburn grew up, which is sort of interesting.
I noticed you described that neighborhood as a force field of style.
Right. And her mother was had been at Auschwitz right before she became pregnant with Diane, and her father had been in an internment camp during the war. So she had this legacy of being the child of Holocaust survivors, and she exhibits a lot of the same qualities as a lot of children of Holocaust survivors do.
And her mother, Lily Halfen, was barely alive when she came out of the concentration camps and was concerned about how bad she looked when she was reunited with her fiancé, Leon.
Right.
But apparently the Halfens wasted no time putting the war behind them. They kind of charged ahead, didn't they?
Right. And I think that that was also true of people who had survived the Holocaust. They were eager to first of all, get married and have children and replace the lost 6 million, or start to do their part to replace the lost 6 million, and to, you know, this sense of renewed life they had of being lucky to be alive infused their enthusiasm on the one hand for life, but on the other hand, there was also these very, very deep, deep wounds that wouldn't heal. And I think the Holocaust survivors have a terrible time. I mean, the last generation now is pretty old and is dying off, but I think they've had, you know, a terrible, terrible time coping with lasting trauma and also physical problems that resulted from the treatment in the camps.
How much did Lily talk to Diane and her brother about the time she spent in concentration camp?
Well, she always put a positive spin on it because she didn't want her children to feel that she had been too damaged, though of course they sensed that because she was depressed and she had physical problems. She had suffered from her eyesight was very bad, for example. But she wanted them to feel optimistic about life and didn't want them to feel sorry for her. And so she always tried to be very positive about what had happened to her, which is a rather grotesque way of looking at the Holocaust. And she had several stories that she told over and over again about, and one of them involved when she had been arrested and she clung to an older woman on the train to Auschwitz. And when they got to Auschwitz, a German soldier separated them, and Lily was devastated because she felt that she needed this woman. And as it turned out, the soldier ended up saving her life because the woman went into the line of people who were gassed, and Lily, probably because her youth, was saved to go to a work detail. And the lesson there was that sometimes what you think is going to be the worst thing that can happen to you is often saving you.
Wow, that's quite a twist on the circumstances there. How big a factor was Lily's life experience in what she told her daughter about what she should do with her life?
Well, I think that she was very ambitious for Diane and always told Diane that she could be more than just a wife. Her own marriage to Diane's father was not happy, and they ended up breaking up. And I think she also realized that she had this very, very strong-minded, very smart daughter who could probably do anything she wanted. And she encouraged Diane, even though Diane was not a good student and didn't have any career ambitions that were hard and fast. She had this sort of inchoate desire to do something with her life, but she had no idea what it was going to be.
So where did Diane von Furstenberg, or then Diane Halfen, go to school?
First she went to school in Brussels, where she was a child, and then she went to boarding school in Switzerland, where her mother had a boyfriend, and then she went to boarding school in England to improve her English, and then after that she went to the University of Geneva, but again she was not a good student, and the University of Geneva was kind of a party school where a lot of the children of the jet set, the baby jet set, were educated, and that's when she got involved with this very fast crowd of wealthy young people.
Did she learn about fashion in school, or was it more of a soaking up of the culture outside of the classroom?
I think it was more of a soaking up of the culture outside of the classroom and being one of the bright young things in this very fast-moving jet-set world. And she always had a natural sense of style and was very social, and that sort of went along with her interest in fashion.
You point out, Joya, that Diane von Furstenberg has been quite frank with you about the central importance of sex in her life.
Yes.
What's generally her attitude about it?
Well, she's had what is considered a man's attitude towards sex, which is that you just take lovers whenever you want them, and that you shouldn't define yourself even by your sexual orientation, because you could fall in love with either a man or a woman. And Diane is predominantly heterosexual and has slept with lots and lots and lots of men, but she's also had affairs with women. She's been married twice, but she doesn't really like marriage, and she never let her marriage, in the case of her first marriage, she never let that stop her from sleeping with other people, and that marriage, in fact, was very short-lived, and she did not get married again until 2001, when she was over 50.
We are talking about Diane von Furstenberg, the subject of the book, Diane von Furstenberg, A Life Unwrapped, written by Joya DiLiberto, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join us on the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone anywhere in the region, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So speaking of suitors, lovers, marriage partners, what were the circumstances of Diane meeting Egon von Furstenberg?
Well, he was also studying in a very desultory way, as she was, at the University of Geneva, and they met at a birthday party and fell in love, and he was part of this circle that introduced her to this group of young, moneyed people. Many of them were also from aristocratic families in Europe.
Was Diane the kind of feminist who did not want to fall in love with a real prince, which he was?
Well, I think she was very attracted to him being a prince. I mean, I think that there was a real cachet to his being a prince. You know, it was at a time when little girls grew up on the fantasy of marrying a prince because of Cinderella. This would have been, you know, in the 50s. And if you grew up in Europe, it was a real reality, possibly, that you could marry a prince, because in Europe there was a royalty. And in fact, Diane's best friend from her childhood also married a prince. So it was considered kind of hitting the jackpot. And that may seem very contradictory to Diane's feminist beliefs. And I don't think her feminist beliefs were really very formed at that time either. I think she was just a girl who was trying to have fun and had a strong personality and knew she wanted to do something interesting with her life, but it was all very unformed in her mind at that moment.
So what was it that brought Diane Halfen, soon to become Diane von Furstenberg, into the center of the fashion industry? What were some of the early jobs and training she had that got her there?
Well, she never really had any jobs or any training. She got pregnant and married Egon and came to New York. And Egon was gay, well, he was bisexual, and he was part of this circle of fashion designers and Eurotrash and nightclub denizens who had all washed up on the shores of Manhattan in the early 70s. And he introduced her to a lot of the fashion designers. And at the time, these designers, like Halston and Stephen Burrows, were forging a new, very American style. It was the first time that American fashion had really come into its own, and it was an exciting time in American fashion. In many ways, it was the last great era of style in New York. And so she got to know these people, and she went into their studios, and she saw how they worked, and that was her training. And she also had an internship with a man that she had met skiing in Europe who owned factories in Italy that produced this very beautiful jersey that became the fabric of the wrap dress. And she learned a lot about how fashion was made from him and his workers.
And we have an email here from Scott in Ashland who asks, and then we should talk about this every couple of minutes, I think, particularly for the men. Can your guest explain what the wrap dress was for those of us who have forgotten or never knew?
Well, it was made out of this very fine fabric, the Italian jersey fabric that, you know, felt like cashmere. And Diane also had great prints that, and the jersey took the prints really well, so the fabric itself was really special. And then the dress was just a simple robe-like garment that wrapped around the body. The original wrap dress had a collar and long sleeves with cuffs, and it came to just the knee. And it was the kind of garment that was flattering on just about any body type because it molded to the wearer's shape. And it also was appropriate for just about every age. So it looked good on a teenage girl or a young woman in the workforce, and it also looked good on their mothers and grandmothers. So it kind of served the whole population of women who were buying clothes.
And how did she make the first prototypes to be able to show something around to people?
Well, she made it at the factory in Italy.
Angelo Ferretti's factory?
Yes, at Ferretti's factory. And she had first started out with a wrap top and a skirt. And then she got the idea of combining the two into one garment, and that became the wrap dress.
Oh, that's right. I remember those skirts now from those days. Yeah, the skirts came first with the you remember the big safety clips?
No, the skirt wasn't a wrap skirt. It was a top that was a wrap.
Okay. I remember skirts that had the big safety pins in them. Anyway,
we're
talking to Joya Diliberto about Diane von Furstenberg, A Life Unwrapped, her biography of the designer. So she was out shopping her designs while pregnant with her first baby, I guess. Yeah.
Right. And because of her social connections through her husband, she knew Diana Vreeland, who was the very popular and powerful editor at the time of Vogue. And so she got an introduction to her and was able to show the clothes to Diana Vreeland and her editors in the Vogue offices. And Vogue did a spread of her clothes, and that also helped to launch her.
She seemed to have a knack through her life of being around famous people or getting their attention and getting in their orbits.
Definitely. She knows everybody. I could have written a separate volume called Famous People Who Know Diane von Furstenberg.
How many people did you end up interviewing for the book in addition to her?
You know, I tried to count them up at one point, and I couldn't. I'd sort of lost track, but there were dozens and dozens and dozens. And I talked to people who were closest to her, her husband and her children and her best friends, her brother, and then also people who worked for her. So I had access to those who were closest to her who are still living.
We have Jamie in Medford sent in a question and wants to know about DVF, whether she ever had experience with Andy Warhol. And there's at least one photograph in the book that says a definitive yes.
Yes, yes. She knew Andy Warhol very well, and it was a kind of vexed relationship because he was very snotty about her and about her clothes. And part of it, and I say this in the book, was that he liked very high-end fashion. He didn't like middle-of-the-road fashion like Diane's. That was one reason. He also preferred transvestites to real women like Diane, and especially strong women like Diane he had a problem with. And he also was kind of anti-Semitic. So he was ambivalent about Diane and wrote a lot of snotty things about her in his diary, which I also quote in the book.
Oh, good. We got that stuff in there, too. The one of the things, then, that this leads to is an obvious question about how the rest of the fashion world responded to this person who came seemingly out of nowhere with this idea that caught fire really fast.
Well, I think people love Diane. She's always been very popular because she's very warm and very loyal, and on a personal level, everyone was very fond of her, but they were not so crazy about her clothes, and part of that was because she did this simple little dress. It was mid-priced and sold in the department stores, and you know, it wasn't considered fashion-forward. She wasn't doing anything that the fashion establishment could get excited about. You know, the fashion establishment was very attached to the high end. And most of the high end also was designed by male designers. So there was a prejudice against her on that level.
All right. Much more to talk about Diane von Furstenberg, A Life Unwrapped with the author Gioia Diliberto. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and take your questions and comments via phone and email as well in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to the biographer Gioia Diliberto about her latest work, a book called Diane von Furstenberg, A Life Unwrapped, about the creator of the wrap dress and so much more. Diane von Furstenberg did participate by giving Gioia Diliberto her time and attention, although it's not an authorized biography in the sense that Diane von Furstenberg did not get final approval of what got printed. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange by phone, 800-838-3760, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So what you were just saying about the way that other fashion designers regarded her sounds like where Diane really made a hit was that she created something that just women, normal folks, felt that they could get into and afford, and that was for them.
Yes, that's true. So, you know, at the time she did the wrap dress, the king of fashion was Halston. I don't know if anybody still remembers him.
Yes.
But he was doing amazing clothes, but they were way more expensive than Diane's clothes were. And he was also a pop culture star, as she became, but his fashion was aspirational in the sense that it was at the high end of the runway, whereas hers was right in the middle.
Which I can see right there, where there's sort of this MOR snobby feeling from the folks at the top end of the fashion food chain.
Yes. I mean, there is, fashion is marked by incredible elitism, and that's what it's all about. You know, fashion is all about exclusion and elitism, and that's why a lot of high-end brands do so well, like Chanel does so well with perfume and sunglasses, and even Tory Burch, who's at the higher end, started out at the higher end of the runway. You know, people will pay a premium price for an affordable accessory by a brand whose clothes they can't afford. So, you know, even people who are buying Diane's dresses are buying Chanel perfume and Tory Burch handbags and Tory Burch flats.
We have a question here from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Gioia Diliberto.
I actually wasn't expecting to get on the air anymore. Initially, I called about the plight of that getting into the high society and coming from high society, like the almost unsurmountable incompatibility between Egon and Diane, because the people who came from aristocracy or money aristocracy, the ones I met in the very 70s that you're talking about, I mean, they were all struggling to find anything to make sense out of their lives. And then we have somebody who, like Diane, from the totally different end of the spectrum. I actually hung up because the question doesn't really, really apply to your biography, except for the real clash that she experienced. Frankly, I wanted to ask if you could call me later or contact me later, because I have a similar biography that I have been trying to develop and that I actually have, and similar circumstances. So that's basically, I don't have that much of a question.
Okay, we'll see if we can make an email connection for you. Not really the place on the Jefferson Exchange to try to work on your projects here, Wolfgang, but thanks for calling. To Wolfgang's original broader point about the lifestyles of the rich and famous here, that Aegon was certainly born mm-hmm. to, Diane much less so, although her family got prosperous after mm-hmm. the Second World War.
Right.
How dissolute it got. I mean, was Diane the kind of person to go on weekend drug and alcohol binges or anything like that?
No, everybody else was. And she had to go to work. And she did a little bit of that, but she had also two children at home that she was responsible for, though she was not, as she even admits, not the most attentive mother at the beginning and even throughout her career, because she was working so hard. But she never lost her mind on drugs, or she smoked a lot of pot, but she got up, and no matter how late she was out the night before, she got up and went to work, and she never overindulged in alcohol, and never, you know, pot smoking was about as bad as it got with her. So I think that her partying was probably over-exaggerated, and she didn't do anything to lessen the impression that she was partying so hard, because it fit into her persona as this glamorous princess. But she was very hardworking.
It's interesting how we do pigeonhole people, though, because just seeing the one picture in the book of her at Studio 54, you start
right.
thinking about the whole Studio 54 crowd, the cocaine, the sex, all that stuff.
Right. Well, there were, well, she certainly was having a lot of sex, but there were a lot of people around her, and I interviewed a lot of them, the ones who were alive, I mean, a lot of them died, you know, who were really having serious drug and alcohol problems, and who just totally flamed out. But that was not Diane at all.
We talked about the response to her clothing, and did catch on really fast. People felt it was accessible. Fashion designers are a little more snubby about this. How was she portrayed generally in the press?
She was portrayed mostly very positively. She used the title of princess when she first started out, and there was a cachet to that in the 70s in New York. And then she stopped using it after a while. She said she stopped using it when she wanted to call herself Ms. And people liked her. She made herself very accessible to the press and was very open with the press, and that always works with reporters. You know, reporters love people who want to talk to them all the time, and that was Diane, very, very open. And so she got a mountain of good publicity. I mean, there was always, you know, there was always a little bit of snarkiness, but it was mostly positive.
Was she pretty good? I mean, you mentioned that one of her major talents is her marketing skills. Mm-hmm. So did she manage to divert the attention that was coming toward her personally to her products, to her clothing?
Well, she used it to sell the clothing. I mean, you know, this was in the 70s when she was young. She was in her 20s. She was this beautiful, glamorous person leading this idyllic life. Nobody knew about the shamble of her marriage until a famous New York magazine cover story that exposed it. But she was living this life that most people could only dream about. And so there was this aura attached to the clothes that had a lot to do with who she was as a person and the kind of life she was living. Oh, if I wear this dress, I'm wearing a little piece of Diane's life, so that you know, a piece of her glamour would be conferred on you by wearing her clothes. So it all helped her enormously.
She probably got some real varied responses, though. I mean, given that she was bridging a time of fairly staid and sober attitudes towards lots of things, and moved through the women's liberation, mm-hmm. you know, the heat of the movement right then at the time that she really began to introduce her stuff. How did her sense of fashion and particularly about her attitudes about sex play within the context of people who were feminists?
Well, the feminists were very anti-fashion, and I write about this a little bit in my book, and a lot of that had to do with the feeling that the fashion industry was responsible for persuading women that they should devote their lives to presenting themselves for the male gaze and that it was holding them back. And it was at a time when even girls on college campuses who wore lipstick were accused of colluding with the male oppressors. So it was a very anti-fashion time. And the feminists also abhorred advertising, which they thought was very anti-feminine, anti-feminist rather. And, you know, I think the case is completely different today. But I think that on the personal level of women who were working and needed a dress for work, they ignored all that to buy Diane's clothes in the department stores.
Jeannie in Medford wanted to ask about the cost of the clothes. So many high fashion designs, she pointed out, are inaccessibly expensive, but
right.
It sounds like this is the kind of thing a working woman could afford to buy.
Right. The dress was under $100 or around $100 when it first debuted, and now it's, you know, between $300 and $400 compared to a higher-end designer that would be, now the dresses are $1,200 to $1,500.
All right, back to her personal life. You mentioned the sham of the marriage to Aegon, where he's bisexual, and it was a fairly open relationship, so they were all free to do other things. So what ultimately ended up their undoing?
Well, there was a story in New York Magazine that where Aegon talked about a threesome that they'd had in Paris, and that was pretty shocking to people, and it was embarrassing to Diane, and it made her realize that that wasn't the kind of life that she wanted, that she didn't want to be part of this couple, and she didn't want to be part of any couple, really. So it was soon after that article was published that Aegon moved out, though they didn't get divorced for many years.
And she had the two kids, Alexandra
right.
and Tatiana.
Right.
How did they do through all of the ups and downs of that marriage?
Well, as they described, or as Alex, Diane's son, described, he lived a pretty typical Upper East Side Manhattan life, which was not a typical American.
Not typical, yeah,
life.
Sure.
But even by the standards of the Upper East Side in Manhattan, his life was unusual because Mick Jagger used to come over and smoke dope with his mother, and he had, you know, all kinds of privileges, such as a castle in Europe and, you know, a house in Sardinia and all that kind of thing. So they were their mother was not around a lot. And they were raised by nannies. Their grandmother was, however, with them at least 3 months of the year, and they were all very close to her. And the both, rather, were very close to her. And, in fact, they are very close to their mother today.
You mentioned Mick Jagger. Let's bring in another name from the 60s and 70s, President Nixon, because there's a vignette in here about seeing President Nixon's daughter, Julie,
right.
having a part in the creation of the wrap dress. Can you
right.
explain that?
Yes, well, that's Diane says that she had this collection with the wrap top and the wrap skirt, the skirt rather, which I mentioned before. And she was watching TV one night. This was at the height of the Watergate scandal, and she saw Julie Nixon either giving a press conference or being interviewed about her father. You know, those of us who are around in those days remember that Julie Nixon Eisenhower was a great defender of her father, of everybody in the family. It was Julie who was out there defending him. And Diane saw her in this wrap top and skirt, and Diane did not support Nixon by any means. And she didn't really have any strong feelings about Julie, except that she noticed how flattering this outfit was and how it seemed to confer on Julie this femininity and yet also professionalism, and enhanced her looks. And she just got the idea right there that she was going to turn it into a dress.
Wow. And was she surprised by how fast the dresses sold once they hit the market?
I think so. I don't think she realized what she had. You know, because just they did the dress and they sent it out there and it just started selling like crazy. And I don't think they had any idea of how it was going to take off.
That monogram, that famous DVF monogram
right.
for Diane von Furstenberg, seems to have come out fairly quickly around that time. But it seems like the brand of Diane von Furstenberg got so big so fast. I mean, honestly, I didn't know that much about wrap dresses until I read this book. But I had Diane von Furstenberg towels when I had my first place after college, that kind of thing.
well, Diane von Furstenberg towels were a low point, and that was part of part of her problem at the end of the 70s or towards the end of the 70s.
They were good tells.
I'm sorry?
They were good
tells. They were good tells because of the licensing. She had gotten involved in a lot of schlock licensing, like paper towels, which had nothing to do with her brand, which was about sexy, on-the-go, glamorous working women. And, you know, as a designer, you really get into trouble when you start going into licensing of products that have nothing to do, that doesn't do anything to feed your brand awareness. And in the 70s was a big time for licensing, and it was thought to be the fastest way to grow a brand, and a lot of designers got very rich doing it, licensing, and the French designers were doing it too, licensing everything from chocolates to inflatable boats to, I think Pierre Cardin even had a sausage machine licensed under his name. But it was a slippery slope, because if you attached your name to too many cheap products like paper towels, it would hurt your image. And that's what happened to Diane.
She's what, 69 years old this year, so does she show any signs of slowing down?
No, she really doesn't, which is perplexing, because she is getting older, and she certainly, you know, has achieved everything she wanted to achieve, and she's very, very, very rich. But I think she wants to leave something to her granddaughter. One of her granddaughters is interested in fashion. Her children are not interested in taking on the business after she retires or is gone. But she has a granddaughter who's still a teenager, is not even in college yet, who has expressed an interest in taking over someday. And I think Diane would like to leave the company in a big enough state and a healthy enough state that she could pass it on.
Well, it truly has been an interesting life and well-documented in Diane von Furstenberg, A Life Unwrapped. Joya Diliberto wrote it and joined us today. Joya, thank you.
Thank you.